There's just something that I find just saying those words, Jesus, only Jesus. It's just Him. You know, and I find in those moments all the different ways that I've dressed Him up. Maybe you've been stirred by that as well, that there's ways that we look at Jesus, that we've come to know Jesus, that look an awful lot like us. I've made Jesus to look an awful lot like me. Strangely enough, Jesus' preferences are my preferences. Strangely enough, the things that make Jesus angry are the things that make me angry. And I don't have to get too far down this road before I begin to realize that I have made Jesus more like me than I have allowed Him to make me more like Him. And so as we spend some time together as a church over the course of a number of weeks, we're taking a look at Jesus for who He is. We acknowledge that we come with certain lenses and perspectives. We bring that to the table, and we're asking God to help us kind of set those aside as best we can so that we can see Him clearly for who He is, that we could catch a glimpse of who Jesus really is, that we could make Him less like us, and we could see Him for more of who He is. Jesus. Just Jesus. It's not fancy. It's not poetic. It's just Him. And so we're taking a look at Jesus through the eyes of one of His followers named Matthew. He wrote a gospel. We've given that gospel His name. There's four different accounts of Jesus' life, and they line up in so many different ways. They offer us some different perspectives. Matthew is one of those perspectives. It's the first of the gospels in the New Testament. And so we're actually going to be taking a journey between now and Easter over the course of the next many weeks. We're taking a journey through Matthew to catch a glimpse of who Jesus is. Now, we started this journey last week, and many of you might have already jumped in and have taken advantage of the little reading thing that we're doing. You got the daily reading. If you haven't done that yet, it's not too late. We're only in chapter 4, so it's not like you got tons of makeup to do. Next week, those people are buried. But this week, you can jump in and be a part of this. We've got some bookmarks in the foyer right out here through these doors. You can stop and get those if you want something paper to tuck in your Bible or your pocket. If you want to just follow along, we post it on our Facebook page every day. There's a reading that goes with that. But it's just a journey that we're taking. We're spending our time here on weekends, but we're also taking this journey throughout the week. And when we get done, we will have accomplished something. We will have read all of the Gospel of Matthew. Now, for some, that might not seem like that big of a deal. Like, I read a book all the time. But for a lot of us, we haven't read since high school. And some of you are in high school, and you don't like the notion of that. And so this is a time for us to, as a church family, take a journey together in your small group here as we gather on our weekends. And we're journeying through Matthew, not just to accomplish the fact that we got through Matthew, but we're doing it to catch a glimpse of who Jesus really is. And as He leads us, as He teaches us, we're going to see how He interacted with people. We're going to listen to Him more carefully. We're going to catch glimpses of Him and who He really is. We're going to watch how He stirs in the hearts of the people that He meets. Today, we're talking about one of those encounters that Jesus had with some pretty important people in His life. It's a moment where He has an RDT. You know what an RDT is, right? It's the relationship-defining talk. If you're married, you've had an RDT. If you've wanted to be married, chances are you've had an RDT. If you're in junior high, you have not yet had an RDT. It will come. These are important moments. These are conversations that can change a life. Yeah, I know it certainly changed mine. I look back on November 19th, 1992. Yes, I remember the day. It was a day that my life changed forever. There was a beautiful young lady on my college campus. I'd got to know her a little bit. We'd played racquetball. She's incredibly competitive. Thankfully, I'm very docile and gentle when it comes to things of competition. No, we had this fiery relationship in the racquetball court, and we used to enjoy playing together, challenging each other across the commons, or challenging each other across the dining hall there. Oh, she was great. And what I found is the more I played racquetball with her, the more we just talked in between sets, the more I was falling for this lady. I mean, she was good looking. She was pretty. She just made my mind all jumbled up mess, because that's what love is. When you can't talk straight, think straight, or anything straight, guys, you're just this jumbled up mess. Well, she was doing that to me, and so the time had come that I needed to have this conversation with her, but I was afraid. Now, I know you probably look at me and think, this guy was probably awesome with ladies, a ladies' man. you know, through my days. But she scared me. Like, the pretty ones scare me. And so she was one of those. So I talked to my buddies. We were playing some euchre. And I was saying, okay, tomorrow is the day. Tomorrow is the day. Do not let me go to bed without having this conversation with this beautiful young lady. So they agreed. These are good accountability guys walking with me in this thing. And so the morning comes and we head over to breakfast together. Those guys never get out of bed for breakfast. I was the one with the early class. But they were like voyeurs. Like, that was before Facebook. And they wanted to see it happen. So they showed up at the breakfast table. And herein comes this beautiful lady. And Heidi sits across the table from me. And I choke. And we don't have the conversation. And the guys walk away disappointed. And we go about our day. And there's racquetball. And this is the perfect moment. But, I choke, and it wasn't going to happen. So I go throughout my day, and the conversation doesn't happen. And so now it's about 10 o'clock at night. I've finished up my homework, got an early morning the next day too, so I'm crawling into bed between 10 and 11. And my roommate says, so how did the talk go? I'm like, I didn't have it today, no big deal. Like, you told us. Oh, no, we're not going to do it today. Nope, get out of bed, you got to do it. You can't end your day without having the talk. Oh, just forget it, right? So I'm talking my way out of this thing, and of course, like good college roommates do, they physically lift me out of bed, throw me on the ground. I guess we're having the talk. So I call her up, say, hey, you want to take a walk? She says, sure. Right? So you just got to start out easy, because you got to be able to bail at any moment if it's not going to work. So I walk over to her dorm, her apartment there, and we begin to walk through the neighborhood, this little college town. We're walking around the neighborhood, and it's nighttime, and you got some street lights, and it's cold. It's November, and so we're cold. We're bundled up in our winter coats, and to this point, like, it's just been a great friendship, a great competition, and all this stuff is going through my head, like, you blow this, and you lose so much. There's so much riding on this conversation, and so then we get to the point, I'm like, oh, we're about ready to turn back towards home. I'm not having the conversation, and finally, we have the conversation, and I declare my affection for her. You know, I don't want to rate it, you know, go too far out on a limb there. I'm just like, I think you're cool. I like you. Right? All the words that betray our deepest emotions. Oh, and I confess my feelings for her, that it is more than just friendship, and that I would want something more in the relationship, and I wondered if a girl like her could ever find herself in a relationship with a guy like me. Just hypothetically. Now, at this moment, you would be expecting probably the same thing that I am expecting, is that in that moment, she wouldn't even let a breath pass before she turns and answers. But she's a wily one, this beautiful young lady. And what does she do? As we're walking along, she takes her face in her zipped-up coat and she just hunches her face down in her coat. And so I can't see anything above her eye or below her eyes. And she waits. And we walk. And we walk. And we walk. You guys are tracking with me. You are understanding how mean this is. What a horrible situation has just emerged here. I just blew up this great friendship. And after what was many minutes, it wasn't like 20, but it was more than 5. After many minutes, she speaks with a simple answer that just says, yes. Oh, like my legs were turned into rubber in that moment, and I could barely walk this, waiting for this answer, knowing that this conversation could make or break so much. Little did I know how that conversation changed my life. And with a gentle reach, we reached over and grabbed each other's hands and completed our walk hand in hand. And thus began the real relationship between Matt and Heidi Furr. 2 years to the day later, we were married. And then I drag her off to New England. Right? What more could a guy do? Oh, the talk. You've felt some of that talk, and some of you were much more smooth than I was. You know, some of you ought to be ashamed you were much less smooth than I was. But we've had those kinds of talks, those talks that change everything, those talks that seem to have a hinge for history. It could go this way or this way, and we feel the significance of that moment, of the question asked, of the statement made, and how will this person respond? It's a moment where we lose control. I can't control what she's going to say in this moment. All I can do is put it out there and then wait and see what happens. As Jesus began his ministry, we found that he's already been baptized. And after his baptism, he went out into the countryside, into the wilderness, led there by God's Spirit, where he was tempted. And if you've been reading this week, you read about that whole encounter. And now as Jesus begins to settle into his public ministry as a rabbi, he has a number of those conversations with various men. Men where he puts it out there. And their reply, their lives, whether they realize it or not, hang in the balance of their reply to the statement, to the question that he offers them. And it's this group of people. You wouldn't expect this group of people. You see, Jesus lived at this point near the Sea of Galilee. And so he was walking along there, and along the shores of the sea would be fishermen, and some of them fish at night and they're just coming in the morning. Others are preparing for the morning shift and they're getting their nets ready to go out. And it's in this context that Jesus is walking along, and we find this conversation that he has. And let's look there. Matthew chapter 4. It's just a few verses we're going to read together, and beginning at verse 18. So flip in your Bible there, open it up on your phone, your Bible app there. But follow along here. It says this in verse 18. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, called Peter, and his brother Andrew. And they were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Matthew's spelling this out for us. Verse 19. Come, follow me, Jesus said. And I will send you out to fish for people. And at once they left their nets and followed him. Now going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. And they were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. And Jesus called to them, same way. And immediately they left the boat and their father, and they followed him. Now, in the scope of Jesus' life, this might not seem all that significant. It might seem like the kind of thing that we could just read in the middle of the week. Let's get to the real stuff of what Jesus is doing. But if we miss the significance of this conversation, we miss the fulcrum point of this relational connectivity that Jesus has. We miss the significance of how he went about doing the ministry that he did. You see, Jesus was no ordinary rabbi. It was common in those days that rabbis would go and they would choose their pupils. You would go to more of a public education to a certain point, probably about what we would call our fourth or fifth grade type of an education. And then it became time, if you wanted more education, then you needed to align yourself with a rabbi. And sometimes if you came from a family that was prosperous, that was wealthy, that was influential, your father might approach a reputable rabbi and on your behalf ask that you would become one of his disciples. And the rabbi would answer yes or no based on your potential. Like, what's your potential? Like, have you got a big ceiling, or are you hovering where the cookies are on the bottom shelf kind of person? And so the rabbi would evaluate and he would determine and either say yes or no based on your potential in following him. Other rabbis would go around and they might even be a little bit more selective, and they would go in and they wouldn't wait for somebody to come to them, but they would go and they would choose. They would watch the young boys, and they would watch how they studied in school and watch how they interacted with others. Who were the leaders? Who were the influential people into this community? And then as a rabbi, I'd step in and say, hey, you, would you like to be one of my disciples? Would you like to be one of my students? And then it was under the tutelage of this rabbi that they would continue their education and take their place in society. Well, Jesus was no simple rabbi. I mean, he was known as a rabbi, and I suspect even at this point he was beginning to get a little bit of a reputation. I mean, they knew who he was, so he had enough reputation that they would recognize him and probably even recognize that he might be somebody worth following. But you see, Jesus was not merely looking to train up people in how they would think. Jesus was a rabbi that was looking to start a revolution in a way of life and how people lived. And so when he looked for disciples, he was looking for something more than just a mental capacity. He was looking at those through which he would launch a revolution, something sustained far after him. Little did they know what their future held. You know, as we consider this notion of Jesus, the rabbi, calling his pupils, calling his disciples near him, by walking along the Sea of Galilee and seeing those who are hard at work fishing, it leads us to an understanding of what disciple-making really is, of what discipleship really is. What does it mean to follow him? One of the things that I've become aware of in my own life, and I even think in the church at large, that we have lived with a number of myths of what discipleship is. If you go into church and spend much time in a church at all, you're going to hear the language of discipleship, and we make disciples, and we're about becoming disciples, and all those kinds of things. But you start having conversation after conversation of what do you mean by discipleship? It'll mean all kinds of things. And a lot of those things are, well, it's my life. Like, right? We base our list of what disciple-making is off of the way that I do my life. Again, just like we do with Jesus, we tend to make him look like us. We tend to make discipleship look like us. And in doing so, we've bought into a number of myths that if we will look closely into this encounter, into this RDT between Jesus and these men who would be his disciples, we will catch a glimpse of what is true. Set aside the myths and be captured by what is true about disciple-making. And so let's look at a few of these myths. One of these myths is, he would never choose me. I realize some of you are sitting here and you feel like you're just kind of sneaking under the bar. Like you're kind of getting away with something. Like if people really knew what was going on in your head, they wouldn't want you. Right? And so we tend to, in buying into this myth, we tend to dress ourselves up all proper. We make ourselves, we have the appearance of somebody who's taken their faith seriously. But in our own mind, in our own head, we're like, oh, if people only knew. Our own brokenness, our own selfishness, the junk that resides within us, we work so hard to hide it. Because if people knew it, they wouldn't choose me. If Jesus really knew who I was, he wouldn't choose me. You might look around at a group like this, you say, well, he'd choose him. Or, I mean, look at her. She's got it together. He would choose her, but he wouldn't choose me. But the truth of the matter is, he's calling you. He's calling to each of us. Look at this. In verse 19, Jesus is reaching out. And he says, come. He points to these guys. He says, come, follow me. He wasn't saying, come, take your aptitude test and let's see what works out. He was issuing the call. He was inviting them in. And they were the most unlikely people ever. See, the simple fact that they were there working in the boats, working by the sea, tells us something. It tells us that they had already experienced a rejection. It tells us that maybe Zebedee, the dad of John and James, maybe Zebedee was a really good fisherman, a prosperous fisherman, and maybe he went to one of the local rabbis or a couple of the local rabbis to kind of sell his sons to them. And they were told no. Perhaps they were young boys who were sitting in their classes knowing that their time in formal school was about to end, and they saw a couple of the rabbis kind of talking to their teachers and wondering and asking questions and pointing to different kids, and they're part of them that wondered, their heart raced and wondered, will I be chosen? And the one next to them was chosen, and the one in the back of the room was chosen, and this one up here in the front, he was always up front, he got chosen. And they were passed over. At some level, they were fishing there as young men because they had been not chosen. And yet Jesus went looking for them. Jesus went there on purpose. He went to the Sea of Galilee to find them. And when he found them, he said, come, follow me. Jesus does know who we are. He knows who you are. He knows your doubts. He knows your fears. He knows your selfishness and your pride that consumes you. He knows the anger that you try to hide but blows up in the most inopportune times. He knows. And still today, he is moving towards you through his Spirit. And he looks at you and he chooses you. He says, you. Come follow me. be my disciple. Follow me. So the first myth is he would never choose me, but Jesus blows that myth out of the water, doesn't he? Look at who he chose, this ragtag group of people. And these were the fishermen. He didn't even gotten to the tax collector yet. That dude was the scum of the earth. That's Matthew himself, the one who wrote this gospel down. Jesus chose the most unlikely people. The people that the society said, hey, these guys have got it together. Like spiritually speaking, this is your A team. Jesus walked by them. And he went to the people that society said, really? Them? That's who you're doing this with? Well, you really must be a low-class rabbi. Because if you were a high-class rabbi, you would have gotten somebody else. But this your crew? That's who Jesus went to. And that's where Jesus still goes today. He runs to the margins of our society for those very same people that the world says, you don't have that much to offer. I mean, look at you. You're kind of weird looking. You walk with a limp. You don't speak all that eloquently. You're not the top of your class. Jesus runs to the fringes of our society. And even those who have achieved much, those who have had much success, like Matthew himself, but are aching for something more, Jesus senses the ache and he runs to you and he says, yes, you've attained much, haven't you? But there's something missing. Come, follow me. He runs to you, and he still is to this day. Come, follow me. A second myth that we often tend to live with is that it will cost me nothing, that it's free. And I will confess, a lot of us as teachers, a lot of us as preachers and leaders in the church, we've sold a bill of goods. Now, it's come from a very good place, all right? It's come from a very good place because we want you to get what Jesus has. Like, Jesus is an amazing thing. He's an amazing person, and I want you to say yes to him. And preachers all over the place, we want you to say yes to him, and teachers want you to respond to him. And so we sell it, and we sell it like a low bar. And so we're like, it's free. Now, the Bible does tell us it's a free gift. Like, salvation is indeed a free gift, but it's free insofar as you can't earn it. Like, there's no pedigree of yours, there's no amount of money, there's no amount of attainment, there's no amount of spiritual togetherness that in which you can earn salvation. So in that sense, it is free. But we have sold, we've kind of sold a bill of goods and build the whole thing as, oh, it's just really simple. All you got to do is just say yes and then go about your business. Will you just say yes? And so we've got this sense that discipleship really doesn't cost anything. And yet the truth is, to say yes to his invitation to follow will cost you everything. Will cost everything you have. Man, I got to be honest. I know some of you are here and you're not even sure what you think about Jesus, and I'm supposed to be trying to convince you that you should give your life to Jesus and follow. And I'm supposed to make it sound easy, like you could, let's seal this deal. What do I need to do to get you to sign on this dotted line today? Right? That's what we're supposed to be saying. But I'm saying to you, it will cost you everything you have. Some of you have been, you've said yes to Jesus a while ago, and you've been trying to live in this easy believism, this cheap grace that the church has sold to people for decades. And you're wondering why it's not working. Nothing's changed. It's not different. It will cost us everything we have. I mean, look at how it captures after Jesus talks to James and John in verse 22. And immediately they left the boat and their father and they followed Jesus. The fishing, it's what they knew. It's who they were. They were fishermen. It was their livelihood. Jesus didn't promise them some pyramid that would make them wealthy in a matter of 4 years. He didn't promise them a salary, a paycheck. He even tells us later that he had no place to lay his head. He had no home. He had nothing to offer them to supplant their fishing. And yet what we're told here is they dropped it. They heard the invitation and they dropped it. It cost them everything they had. Everything they had was wrapped up under the patriarchal authority of their father. He was their authority figure. He was the one who led their life, that ruled their life, so to speak. Not in a bad way. I'm sure he might have been a good dad. We don't know. But in that society, your father was the authority. And they left that. Your father was your identity. Who are you? I am Larry's son. They were the sons of Zebedee. Like, your father is your identity. They dropped their income. They dropped their identity. It's who they were. It cost them everything in that simple act of saying yes. And while Jesus is today moving throughout this crowd, through his Spirit, moving here today and saying, will you come and follow me? That answer will cost you everything. It costs us everything. You notice that when Jesus talks to people, he had different asks for them. But whenever Jesus asked them, he was always asking them for everything. Their everything looked different. And so we have fishermen here who gave up their boats and their nets. We have a tax collector who gave up his position, his protection by the Romans, and his income, his wealth. A rich young ruler, we hear his story a little bit later on, and he comes to Jesus and says, what must I do? He was kind of eliciting this, how do I become one of your disciples? And Jesus says, sell everything you have, give it to the poor, and then come follow me. Some said yes, and some said, oh no, the cost is too high. Sorry, I thought it would be a little bit easier than that. I thought I'd just pay a little deposit here and move on. But whenever Jesus asked them, he asked them for everything. Jesus had a way of seeing what everything was. Have you noticed that? Like, he knows what everything is. I'm fine with your everything. It's when he begins to mess with my everything that I have a problem, right? So he's asking, and I say, well, of course he's asking for your money, because I'm not worried about whether he's asking for my money or not. Of course he's asking for your money, and we'll preach and we'll talk about it, and this is like, your everything is everything and important. And then the eye turns to me, and Jesus says, Matt, what about your everything? Oh, really, Jesus? Really? No, that's not that big of a deal. There's nothing here. We hide it behind our backs, and we play coy with him. Jesus had this way of seeing what everything is. He had this way of seeing that which we grab onto with white knuckles, that with which we claim our identity, that which gives us meaning. Jesus just has a way of seeing that. So as he walks up to us, says, that thing that you're holding onto, what thing, Jesus? That thing that's behind your back. Oh, this, that's no big deal. I'm just going to keep this. He says, let me have that. No. This is important to me. Jesus, I'm giving you all this. And Jesus says, but I want that. Have you ever had those conversations with Jesus? You kind of go back and forth. And you're like, no. And he says, yes. And you say, no. And he says, yes. He just has a way of knowing what that thing is that we hold on to for our meaning, for our significance, for our sense of safety. He says, give me that. You hear the call of the rabbi, and he says, come, follow me. And for those of us who have lied to you and said it will cost you nothing, I'm sorry. But the truth is, it will cost you everything you have. It will cost you everything you have. It will cost you that. It will cost you your money. You're like, I know, 10% tithing. Are you kidding me? Dude, seriously, 10%, we're just getting going. He wants it all. He lets you borrow the other 90%, but we're just getting going there. And you go, oh, money. We don't talk about money in church. That stays here. It's going to cost you relationships. Young lady, you're being wooed by that man. That young man, he's no man, he's a boy. And he's telling you what love looks like. And you're not sure that it's true, but you're aching, you're hungry for it, and so you give in. It's a relationship that will steal your soul. It's going to cost you your relationships. It's going to cost you your sense of worth and meaning. It might cost you your pride. It's going to cost you your anger. Right, that anger, the resentment that fuels you. I mean, that's what gets you up in the morning. You're going to prove to your dad that you aren't who he said you were. You're going to prove to your mom that you are better than she thought you were. You're going to prove to that boss who fired you that you've got what it takes. You're fueled by the resentment. When the rabbi says, come follow me, he wants even that. It will cost you everything. And the third myth that we so easily buy is that nothing's going to change. It kind of springs out of that second myth that says it's not going to cost you anything. Really, it's just sign on the dotted line today. You're going to go about your life. You're going to go about your life. You're just going to walk with Jesus. Nothing really is going to change. When we say yes to the rabbi, everything changes. Like, really, everything changes. Now, it doesn't change all at once. This is one of the things that I love about him. This is true about that number two myth as well. There's this thing that when we say yes to him, we feel like this is everything. And as we journey down this road, we find that that isn't everything. And so Jesus, in his mercy and his grace and his kindness, he says, well, I want that too. Well, like, but I already gave you everything. He says, well, no, but you see, you're hanging on to that too. What, this too? Yeah. And so he moves us down the road like this thing. And the same is true with what he changes in us. There are moments that change us, that free us, that we walk in something new and alive. You've experienced this. As you've said yes to him, as you've prayed to him, maybe for the first time, you feel a lightness. I hear people talk about this. I experience this myself. There's a lightness. I don't feel like the burden of my junk is weighing me down anymore. I'm free. Right? That's a taste of the change. And then what happens is we invite his spirit to live in us. And the values of Jesus become our values. The priorities of Jesus become our priorities. The perspectives of Jesus become our perspectives. You see, it changes everything about who we are. Again, look at this in verse 19. Jesus says, come follow me, and I will send you out to fish for people. I love how he does this. He meets them where they're at. He uses the language of who they are. They're fishermen. They understand fishing. And Jesus doesn't say, come follow me. I'm going to make you incredible business people and you're going to love it. He says, no, I'm going to take that which you know and we're going to use it to advance my kingdom. I'm going to teach you how to fish for people, for souls. See, in that moment, when they said yes, when they dropped their nets, when they followed after him, when they said yes, everything changed. Everything about them changed. There's a great little book by Kyle Edelman. It's called Not a Fan. And it draws this distinction between being a fan and being a follower. You know, a fan is a person who is an enthusiastic admirer. Like, you see fans at football games and basketball games. You see fans lined up for Star Wars. You even see some crazy fans, right, lined up at Star Wars. He's all dressed up, and it seems weird. So there's even levels of fandom. But Jesus didn't come looking to expand his fan base. Jesus came looking for followers. He came looking for those who would follow him. See, the difference is found in what it means to be a follower. A follower is somebody who will watch and who will see what Jesus does. See, Jesus didn't say, hey, you want to be my students? Meet me in class Monday at 9. We'll be done by 3. You can go back about your business. You got a little bit of taste of me. I'll pass some things off, but you've got your life. Jesus said, come follow me with everything you have. Come watch. Watch and see who I am. Listen to the words that I say. And they did. They followed. They were uptight. They were crowding in on Jesus because they didn't want to miss a thing. You see, a follower learns to see and observe where the master is. A follower learns to listen to his words. And at first, it might seem a little bit trivial that we would say the same things that he would say. Like, what would Jesus say in this moment? Okay, this, and we kind of say it. But pretty soon, again, as we change, as the Spirit comes alive in us increasingly, we find that who he is flows from us. A follower is somebody who's invited to live the life of their master. Not just recite his thoughts, but to live his life. And Jesus invited them in to see and to listen. And he invited them to do. I love those moments where he sends them out, go, the stuff you've seen me do, he says, go do those things, and then come back and we'll talk about it. Or those moments of like, you pray for the demon-possessed person, let's see what happens. Are you kidding me? There's these moments, and I don't know if I can do it, and he, all their doubt. And the brash one, Peter, says, call to me, Lord, and I'll walk on the water too, and he begins to walk on water. They do what they saw the master doing, and they follow in his footsteps. See, Jesus is not looking for more fans. As much as we get satisfaction about the easy yes, the quick response, the pray a little prayer, As satisfying as those can be in a moment, they don't change much of anything. What changes is when we say yes. When we say yes to his invitation to follow. Will you follow me? Your response to that question will determine everything about your life. What you say in response to the invitation to follow will determine everything about your life, not just your eternity. It's not just we say yes now so that someday when I die I get to go to heaven. It changes now. It will cost you everything now, and he's calling you now. I was so inspired when I saw this in the life of a couple. A few years ago, I got to go to India. And as I traveled to India, I got to meet this young couple. And they were just a recently married couple. And they had given their lives to Jesus. I'm not going to share with you their names because it's important for a lot of reasons that we don't do that. But I got to meet them. I actually got to sit in their room. Their room wasn't much bigger than like twice of these carpet places. But we got to sit together and pray together. After they gave their lives to Jesus, they were prepared for baptism. And on the day of their baptism, this is the day that they would publicly declare their allegiance to Jesus, that they were going to follow Jesus. And they would be baptized in the Ganges River, the river of mythical impact in Hinduism. And so they headed down to the Ganges. And they brought with them a great big sack. And in that sack was all the idols from their home. As I sat in their humble little home, I could see the spots in the walls, the places that were carved out that were now empty. And you could see all the places that they had pulled these idols from. They were idols made of silver. Some were even laden with gold. They had economic value to them. They had historical value to them. They had been passed on from generation to generation in their family. And upon their marriage, their family had bequeathed them certain of these idols that would care for them as a young family. And the holes in the wall stood empty. And the bag that they held as they approached the river was filled with these idols. And before they were baptized, they literally took the bag and they swung it as far out into the river as they could muster. And it cost them everything. It cost them their family. Their family was horrified at what they had done. The least you could do is give those idols back to us so we could keep them in the family, but you threw them into the bottom of the river. One of the things we were praying for with their family is with this young couple is they had a hard time having a baby and conceiving. And they were praying to God, the God who made them, that they would have a child. And their family taunted them, said, "You're praying to that false God. If you would have kept this idol, he's the God of fertility. We gave it to you. You would already have a child." And so their family mocked them. Their family shunned them. It cost them everything. But they stayed. They stayed true to Jesus. It's been hard. They still don't have a child. I ask every time I talk to my friend Bijou, I ask him if they still don't have a baby. But they're seeking God for this. And in their discouragement, they don't stop following. And they, day after day, they choose to follow him. I sit with them and I find myself thinking, I am not worthy to even sit in your home. What you have done in following him puts my cost of followership to shame. And yet the invitation doesn't change country to country. It doesn't change culture to culture. It doesn't change generation to generation. Every generation has heard the call of the Spirit of God, that same call that emanated from the mouth of Jesus that said, "Come, follow me." He's calling to you. He's calling to you. He's calling to you. And the question that hangs in the balance, the question that he is waiting to hear you answer, will you follow me? Let me pray. Jesus, we hear the call. We hear your voice. And we're sobered by the cost. Not sure that we want to pay it. We're not sure what it's going to mean if we say yes. And yet there's something that stirs in our heart, Jesus, that you would choose us. That you would choose us to be your followers. That you would choose us to be yours. And so God, in that stirring that we feel in our hearts, we respond to you And we say yes. God, show us what it is to follow. Show us what it is that we hold on to that's not you. Show us what that cost is. And strengthen us through your Spirit to follow you, recognizing that everything changes, that we would follow you. Fill us with you, Lord Jesus, as we say yes. Amen.